Welcome to our Women's Roundtable podcast, a co-production of the Forward Sisterhood blog and Lilith Magazine. I'm Gabrielle Berkner, web editor of the Forward, and I'm here today with Forward editor Jane Eisner.
Hello, Gabby.
Hi, with Lilith editor Susan Weidman-Schneider.
Hello.
And with Lilith associate editor Sonia Izard.
Hi, Gabby.
So this is our first podcast in 5771, so happy new year to all. Today we'll be talking about the word balabusta, Yiddish for housewife or homemaker, and whether modern women should be embracing this term or eschewing it. We will also take a look inside the new conservative Machzor, which contains more inclusive liturgy than its predecessor. And then we'll turn our attention to the horrible rape epidemic in Haiti's tent cities. Jane is recently back from a reporting trip there. So we'll begin with balabusta. One of our contributors, Alyssa Strauss, wrote a much-discussed piece about embracing her inner balabusta, how she loves making her home beautiful and comfortable for herself and for her husband. And the essay inspired pretty lively debate on the Sisterhood blog about how much pride we should be taking in housework. And interestingly enough, the younger women in their late 20s and early 30s, newly married, felt much more warmly about embracing balabustahood than a couple of our writers in their 40s who said, you know, housework has nothing to do with who I am. It's just something to get done. It's something to divide equally between spouses. Susan, where do you come down on this?
Well, I have a lot of ambivalence about it. And it's interesting that for the editorial in Lilith's fall issue, which is now, I hope even as we speak, rolling off the press, I wrote about my ambivalent feelings about kitchen because I had been given as a bat mitzvah gift many years ago by my next door neighbor a cookbook, a Betty Crocker cookbook, in which she inscribed, "This more than anything will make you and those you care about happy." And it was stunning to me, even as a kid, you know, there was supposed to be more than this, even at 13, I who had never cooked a meal in my life. But that said, you know, if we fast forward a little bit, I've also believed that we should seize back the language that balabusta and the yenta also, you know, the magician who knows everybody's business, that we can kind of resurrect those images. That said, this is like on the third hand, on the fourth hand, Rabbi Susan Schnur, Lilith's senior editor, often talks about sacred domesticity. And there is something quite lovely. I mean, we come out of a Jewish tradition where we're celebrating Sukkot now, which is creating a home inside a fragile structure, that it's important to beautify it. It's important for it to matter to us what goes on in those four walls. So I think I come down squarely in the middle.
Jane, do you think there's a feminist argument in this, that by embracing the moniker balabusta, that we are in some way placing value on work that's been traditionally done by women?
Gosh, I don't know. I think I share a lot of Susan's ambivalence. This may be because we're not in that younger cohort. It also may be for myself now, and I'm just speaking for myself, I'm not very good at housework. I like to cook, and I surely like to have many people in my home. Just had 25 people in my sukkah. Well, they didn't all fit this past of Shabbat. But when it comes to, you know, cleaning the oven or making children's Halloween costumes or all the other things that I really failed at when my children were little, I think it's just, for me, a level of competency. It should be about choice. I think that women of my generation rebelled against being forced to feel that we were just housewives or that was going to be our highest calling, because that was all we had. If a woman is choosing with her husband and with her family or with her partner and her family to focus on that aspect of creating a home, wonderful. But it ought to be a choice made by the family unit.
I want to chirp in with another thought, and maybe this ties in with what your experiences were in Haiti, Jane. I was struck as I was writing this editorial about my own ambivalence, and there's a new exhibition about kitchen design that just opened at the Museum of Modern Art. And that has to do with, are we fetishizing what goes on in the home? The most perfect dessert tray, the most gorgeous this and that. And we know from Jewish tradition that you're supposed to beautify Shabbat, you beautify what goes on at your table. The table is like the ark. On the other hand, there are people who don't have what to put on the table. And I think my worry is, how can we appreciate what goes on under our own roofs and at the very same time make sure that we're not keeping the focus entirely inward?
I understand what you said about the fetishizing of like the kitchen and the home. But I think when I think about Balabusta, and what's appealing to me is not sort of the perfect Martha Stewart table, but thinking back to sort of how our ancestors lived and, you know, doing what they can with what they had and inviting people into their home who maybe didn't have a place for a meal.
One of the things that maybe is a little bit different now is that if people are having children later, or, you know, there's some more flexibility in what you're talking about, Jane, in terms of having it be a choice, but you get to think about things that are like, people care a lot about food politics now. They like to have really beautiful food, but that has a political element in terms of making sure it's local, or making sure it's green, or making sure it's from the market that's down the street in a way that people feel very passionate about. And I think that that's one way of, maybe one of the reasons why the idea of the Balabusta has been reclaimed or been sort of re-energized, is because there is this way that younger people who have figured out a way to make it have some more weight to it in a way that doesn't feel like you're backed into a corner, but that you have some agency in making it meaningful on multiple levels.
Right. I agree, except I don't think that is new. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the era of, you know, lettuce boycotts and grape boycotts and Diet for a Small Planet. To some degree, I think that's, you know, at the heart of keeping kosher. Mm-hmm. It's the same idea of sort of mindfulness about food.
One of the things that is different, though, is that we're talking about a cohort that has delayed marriage and child-rearing. So, Jane, you connected Balabustahood with sharing the raising of children. Mm-hmm. And Sonia, maybe among your cohort, it's a matter of making a lovely home with a roommate, with a partner, not necessarily with children, where there's a sense of doing it with a community of one's peers, not necessarily in one's own little domestic unit. So it takes on a different political mm-hmm. valence.
So let's turn our attention to the conservative movement's new High Holiday prayer book. Is it Machzor Lev Shalem? With prayers that refer not only to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but also to Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. It also includes commentary and poetry that reflects the lived experiences of women. I can't say that I used it this High Holy Day season, but I've heard rave reviews from those who have. Jane, I believe you used the Machzor.
I did. I worship in a small group that for over 20 years has put on its own Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services. And many of us had the Machzor, but it was not the main thing that we were using. But we have a pretty traditional but egalitarian service, so it wasn't hard to follow. I just loved it. I mean, from a general perspective, I like the fact that there was a lot of instruction, that there was transliteration of some of the major prayers so that people who didn't know the service well enough could feel included. There was interesting explanations and commentary. But I especially appreciated the way I felt that it legitimized the role of women, including the Imahot, as you mentioned, Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca, and Leah. But also farther than that, like the Hineni prayer, which is one of the main prayers that the person who's leading the worship says, was for the first time I'd ever seen, translated for both a man leading it and a woman leading it. And the Hebrew is different because Hebrew is a gendered language. And that's a really important prayer where you're basically saying, I'm here representing this congregation. And it just so happens in our little service that many times the person who's saying the Hineni is a woman.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Jane. I had the real pleasure and privilege of using the Lev Shalem, full heart, Machzor, mm-hmm. At Congregation Anshei Chesed in New York for Rosh Hashanah. And I hadn't even opened it before. I hadn't visited their website. I knew that it existed. I sat down, I opened it, and physically the layout of it is very beautiful, and it looks like a traditional text, but with a marvelous typeface. And then suddenly, as I began to read through, not only the fact that there is a completely egalitarian construct for the major prayers, and in this case, with a female chazana, chazanit, one hesitates to use the sort of diminutive sounding chazanit, but it was stunning to be in the congregation, to hear the Hineni delivered in a female voice, and mm-hmm. to see that the prayer book respected it. It wasn't just an addendum, mm-hmm. but also the fact that the poetry chosen was poetry that felt like my generation. I felt included not only as a woman, but in a very contemporary way. This is the first Machzor I've ever used where I felt this was sort of my moment in the tradition. I don't mean that to sound narcissistic, but I meant that it really mm-hmm. felt that it spoke to me. I then was at Yom Kippur services in Washington where the more usual the Harlem Machzor was being used, the more usual conservative movement Machzor, and I felt a real sense of loss. So, and I was reminded of the comment that Rabbi Sandy Eisenberg Sasso made some years ago when she talked about women's liturgies, and she said, "We will know that women's prayers have made it into our canon when a book of women's sayings and prayers is bound between hardcovers, and if it falls, we pick it up and we kiss it." Mm. So certainly we would do that with the Machzor, which we hope doesn't fall. But there was that same sense of complete legitimization, and it was just a joy to daven with. Sonia. This sounds like a brief commercial announcement, right? Oh, I really did love it.
Brought to you by Lev Shalom. Sonia, how important is it to you to have Jewish liturgy recognize women of the Torah? Is gender equity, neutrality, sensitivity something that you value in a prayer book?
Oddly enough, I mean, I hesitate to say it, but not, it's not my number one priority, I have to say. I think that's speaking from a place of privilege. I realize that having grown up in a Reconstructionist minyan within a conservative shul, I grew up in a absolute smush of egalitarian versus, you know, non versus, you know, this prayer book with that prayer book. So it was always so, you know, mushy that I could take it for granted that, you know, it never was sort of the sticking point for me in terms of making me feel included or not, actually. I have a part of me that really responds to the really sort of bare bones, old sounding text. It doesn't bother me. I have to be totally honest. I had a interesting experience these chagim. I was leading the children's services at my shul, and I sort of made their machzor. Really, the challenge was how to include children and young people. And as the leader, which is something I'm, you know, I can say now, vastly underqualified to do, the challenge was non-gendered. The challenge was absolutely in terms of engaging young children, older children, their parents, their grandparents, whoever was there with them.
It's really interesting. Yeah, I don't have a terribly visceral reaction to hearing Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but at the same time, at a time when the majority of rabbinical students in the Reconstructionist and Reform movement are women, and I think something like 40% of the JTS students are women, it's probably about time to include prayers by women and commentary that reflects the experiences of women in a book that's not just for women, but for everyone.
It's adding to what's there and not taking away from it.
So let's now turn to a much more heartrending topic, and that's Haiti. As I said earlier, Jane, you recently returned from a reporting trip there, and you've written some really powerful pieces, both news and commentary, about your experience in the earthquake-ravaged country. One thing you mentioned in the piece was that the tent cities that have sprung up in and around Port-au-Prince, because the homes are just rubble, are very dangerous places to be female. Why is that?
So about 1.5 million people were displaced by the earthquake on January the 12th, and most of them are living in these tents, in these displaced persons camps in and around the capital city. And they are literally just tents. I mean, it's better than nothing, but as you can imagine, there's very little privacy and very little security. I did not myself witness any bad violence. I was there, you know, with a very small group of Americans and under good security. But we were told of many, many instances where women are really quite afraid just to leave their tents at night and go to the toilets, you know, the outdoor toilets and outhouses that were set up. You know, in one case, I was told that women will wear 5 pairs of jeans just to help kind of delay any potential attack. At the same time, when you're in Haiti and you talk to the people on the ground who are coping with this disaster, it's just astonishing to hear of their resilience and creativity. One of the organizations that American Jewish World Service funds was actually just organizing to purchase and distribute little lights that were given to women in the camps so they can have them, and then to set up patrols so that they had that kind of protection. So there's a lot that people are doing in response to this. In addition, of course, there's also this just when disasters like this happen and they affect so much of the population, there's only 9 million people who live in Haiti to begin with, it just scrambles the whole social structure. And there actually could be some good to come out of that. A lot of women now realize that they've got to work, that they've got to provide. And there are some amazing efforts to try to help them do this. I mean, we spent some time with an organization. I will mangle the Spanish, so I won't try to name it. But it's actually of women from the Dominican Republic. They share an island, not a language, and in many ways not a culture, but still there's a lot of family ties and a lot of desire. I mean, they were like the very first people in Haiti after the earthquake. And we met these amazing women from the Dominican Republic who are working in the displaced persons camp and helping the women there to gain skills. So eventually, when they can go back home or to a new home, they'll be able to do this, some of these things.
Lilith ran a back page a couple of issues back by Marjorie Salvadon, a Haitian-American woman, writing right after the earthquake and talking about the difficulties of expressing grief in Haitian culture and how much she had learned from her, she's married to a Jewish man, from her introduction to Judaism class about being able to express that grief. And I saw her this past weekend. She spoke about having gone back to volunteer and saying that her family, professionals, middle-class people in Haiti, whose lives, of course, also have been shattered, not in quite the same way as those of the people living in the tent cities. But the question that arises is both one of dealing with the realities, how do you gain the skills to rebuild a society economically, but also what happens, and we saw this in the wake of Katrina, when trust vanishes, when there is this kind of violence and when there is gender violence and when it is your people turning against you. Mm-hmm. And the women being raped or attacked in the tent cities are not being raped and attacked by marauding others. And many issues around the enormous psychological trauma of this, with families rent apart and grandmothers giving up their grandchildren to orphanages, not selling them, but because they actually cannot feed them, where the children were orphaned because both parents were killed in the earthquake, for example.
Did you guys hear about Mac McClellan, who writes for Mother Jones? She was live tweeting some of the graphic details about the rapes there, and there was just a big... She wrote, one of her tweets was, "On my way to the hospital with a girl whose tongue was bitten off when she was raped." I mean, very graphic, horrible things. And there's been this whole debate over whether it's an appropriate venue to share this information. Are you going to shock people? Is Twitter too, is it too irreverent a place to be sharing that kind of information? And I was thinking, no, I mean, this is shocking stuff. This is terrible stuff. Like, you know, shock people with it. I mean, not to say that she should only tweet it. She'll probably write a, multi-thousand word piece in Mother Jones as well about the issues there.
I agree, except I just hope that people will then go on to read the longer piece, because you want to have context here. If you just hear something like that, and all of us, Gabby, when you were reading this, were just grimacing in pain, that's not the last reaction we really have to have as responsible human beings. I mean, what we have to do is figure out, okay, what's the context? Because, of course, we don't want to just sit here and demonize all Haitian men.
No.
And then what do we do about it? You know, I'm not saying we should all go down there. There are organizations there that are doing something about them. Maybe we find out the best ones and figure out how to support them. The only worry I have in these kind of telegraphic messages is that they dull your senses and they leave you feeling hopeless. And we can't feel hopeless.
You know, thinking about what Jane is telling us about the situation in Haiti and the need for supporting the good work that's going on there, I was thinking about a marvelous few lines, again, from the Lev Shalem Machzor, but borrowed, I think, from the earlier Machzor that I'd mentioned as well. And that's a few sentences that speak about how extraordinary was it that our ancestors could give of their paltry stores of grain or from their precious livestock to sacrifice them on the altar, to give out of the very little that they had. And we live lives of such plenty, I'm paraphrasing the Machzor rather clumsily here, how much easier is it for us to do good works and to worship, to give of ourselves than it was for them they did it, and of course the obligation is upon us to do it as well.
Now to a much, much, much lighter topic. Last week, I don't even know how to transition here, but last week there's a new sitcom on CBS starring William Shatner. It's called Bleep, My Dad Says, the S word, My Dad Says. And it's about all the wacky and wise things that that one man's septuagenarian father tells his son. But I think Jewish mothers, I think we could probably all agree, can be equally wacky and wise. So I thought we'd end by going around the table and sharing some of our mothers' or our grandmothers' gems. So, Sonia, why don't you go first?
My grandmother, who's kind of a brilliant woman, she one thing that she always said that has stuck with me, particularly at this very period in my life that's always full of transitions, she always used to say, plan 5 years ahead. Never more, never less. You know, anything more than 5 years you can't know, so don't bother. Anything less is not farsighted enough, so just stick with 5 years. And she's 91, so I feel like I should listen to that.
Susan?
I was thinking, actually, when you proposed that, when you asked that question, Gabby, about one of the things that my mother had said, and my mother was somebody who was both very practical and very much a balabusta and also an artist and directed plays and wrote plays and sang professionally and had her own Yiddish language radio program and so on for many years. But I was thinking as I was in the middle of high holiday preparations, my mother saying, Susan, dear, you can't cook soup by proxy. And she meant, of course, much more than that. But you cannot be doing, you know, you cannot be multitasking and imagine that miraculously things are going to turn out well. I thought also of something she had quoted my grandmother as saying, and I don't ever recall my beloved Baba saying this, that my grandmother had said, the only thing it's good to do with other people's hands is pick up burning coals. Which is to say, I mean, my delightful, soft-spoken, gentle Baba. But the thought being that you are responsible for the tasks you take on, that you can't deploy. I think it's another way of you can't cook soup by proxy.
You know, I was asking my mom, like, what should I share? What are some things that you used to say to me? And I said some of the things I remembered, and she was like, did I do anything right? Did I say anything right? And she did do a lot of things right. But so did her mother, Beth Rosen, and Beth's sex ed lesson for my mother was not until you have a ring on that finger, and meaning no sex until she was married. And while I don't necessarily subscribe to that interpretation, I think it does speak to the significance of marriage, like heterosexual or same sex. And certainly there are things that I wouldn't do until I had the proverbial ring on my finger, whether it would be buying a house together, which my husband and I just did, or an apartment, actually, and, you know, joining finances and other things, too. I think there's things you should save until you have a ring on that finger, whether you actually choose to wear a ring or not.
My late mother had just a catalog of crazy sayings and things. I guess the one that comes to mind right now in light of our balabusta conversation, and maybe this will bring it full circle, is she was a homemaker and very, very good at it. I am not so good at it, but always had a big career and whatever. One day she was at my house and I was peeling an orange and I put the peel down the garbage disposal and she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm putting the peel down the garbage disposal. She said, no, you must save the peel. You must grate it, put it in the freezer. And then the next time you bake, you will have orange peel. And I turned to her and said, Mom, I've got 3 children, a really big job, and thank goodness, a very good marriage. I don't have time to make my own orange peel, never mind to bake. And so she just took my admonition, and the next time she came to visit, brought some grated orange peel.
Those gems will round out the podcast. We invite you to visit the Frankly Feminist magazine Lilith at www.lilith.org and The Forward, which is home to our women's issues blog, The Sisterhood, at www.forward.com. Jane, Susan, Sonia, thanks so much for joining me. And thank you to Nadja Spiegelman for her production and engineering help on this podcast. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Gabby.
Thanks, Gabby.